I am sitting here with the chairperson of the Financial and Fiscal Commission, Dr. Bethuel Sitai, and Air Commissioner, Ms. Tanya Ajam. We would like to welcome everybody that is here. Let me first of all recognize the impending presence of the Deputy Secretary to Parliament, Mike Kutsia, who is supposed to be here representing the Speaker and the Chairperson, the Speaker of the NA and the Chairperson of the NCOP. I'm told he's running a bit late, so but we thought that we need to start because people have other engagement. Let me also recognize the presence of the Honorable Speaker of Gauteng Legislature, Honorable Ms. Lindiwe Masebo. Recognize the presence of honorable members of parliament. Some of them, I think, are chairpersons designate. I'm not going to call them chairpersons. I'll call them chairpersons designate because that's what I'm told they are. And then let me also recognize the presence of the media and colleagues that are here today. The purpose of this briefing is basically to share a few matters arising from the submission on the Division of Revenue Bill for 2010-11 financial year by the Financial and Fiscal Commission. This submission is basically made in compliance with Chapter 13 of the Constitution and the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act. The submission basically addresses a number of issues of which I'm not going to say anything. I will leave that to the chairperson of the commission. He will take you through a brief briefing around what is coming out of the commission's work, and then we will after that take questions if they come. Thank you, Dr. Stein.
Okay, thank you, Bongani, and good morning. I don't want to be a culprit or a city doctor. Thank you very much. And thanks for coming. And we will read a brief statement, maybe 15 minutes or less, on the FFC and the recommendations, as Bongani has indicated. So I'll start off with a background and mandate of the Commission. The Financial and Fiscal Commission is a statutory institution. It is a permanent expert commission with a constitutionally defined mandate, set of generic responsibilities and institutional processes dealing with intergovernmental fiscal relations in South Africa. The advice and recommendations that the commission provides is defined by the constitutional and legislative mandate. The remit of the FFC at its conception was to contribute towards reducing spatial distortions inherited from the apartheid rules, backlogs, and other related problems. According to the 1996 Constitution, this was done in the context of established spheres of government that were distinctive, interdependent, and interrelated. Section 214 of the Constitution obliges the FFC to consider factors such as economic disparities, national interest, the funding of basic services, and other developmental needs in making recommendations on the division of revenue between and among the three spheres of government. The implication here is that recommendations made by the FFC must be developmental in orientation. In order to address these issues and dynamically changing intergovernmental relations environment, the Commission developed a new research strategy to inform its recommendations. The primary focus of the new strategy is on outcomes of government interventions with and across various spheres. The FFC has its own conceptual challenges. Some may interpret its recommendations as federalist, while others may think of them as too centrist. There are even some that may perceive the FFC to be encroaching on policy matters. What business does the FFC have with policy, they may ask. This is a purview of elected officials. Others may even go further and say oversight work is the responsibility of elected parliamentarians. Yet stakeholders, especially in the provinces, call for the FSC to track the impact of its recommendations. While considering these concerns, the FSC maintains its independence, objectivity, and impartiality. Thus, the FSC takes its mandate directly from the Constitution and related legislation. However, while the mandate of the FSC is clear and fixed, its interpretation needs to change over time in response to the significant challenges that come with change in government every 5 years and the changing international environment. What is evident in our intergovernmental system is that not only must the FSC focus on the distribution of nationally collected revenue, but recently it has had to focus on developmental impact. That is how do mobilized resources impact on the people's lives. I'll now come to a section, intergovernmental fiscal relations and the macroeconomic environment. South Africa has a reputation for sound fiscal management, financial markets that are opening progressively over time, and prudent regulatory regime. However, there is a growing awareness of the big challenges that lie ahead. This includes, at the macroeconomic level, maintaining a reasonable deficit to gross domestic product ratio, an inflation rate that is within acceptable targeted limits, an economic growth rate sufficient to make inroads into high unemployment and poverty levels, as well as an acceptable balance of payments deficit. At a subnational level, the challenges include subnational borrowing and poverty alleviation and improved access to basic services. The emergent intergovernmental fiscal relations system is a relatively new initiative in South Africa and is enshrined in the Constitution. In this regard, the system continues to have issues that must still be addressed in the course of its evolution and implementation. While it has been relatively straightforward to deal with funding of own responsibilities at national, provincial, and local government levels, the challenge for devising effective approaches for funding concurrent functions, that is education, health, social development, and housing, remains. A misalignment between national priorities and provincial budgets has often been identified as an obstacle that compromises service delivery. This problem continues to persist despite the establishment of technical and intergovernmental forums tasked with the responsibility to improve intergovernmental coordination in the spirit of cooperative governance stated in Chapter 3 of the Constitution. Put simply, the problem is to ensure that the government and ministers at national level have an influence on the funding of national priorities in provincial budgets. On the other hand, provincial and local governments are concerned that their discretion to reflect local priorities will be curtailed. In other words, there are perceptions that, whether genuine or not, that national government is encroaching in the arena of subnational government responsibility. To address this issue with specific reference to provinces, in this submission of ours for 2010 Division of Revenue document, the FSC recommends that expenditure assignments between provinces and national government should distinguish between delegated and own responsibilities. That clear separation of instruments in the transfer system and the provincial equitable share be introduced. That more revenue autonomy for provinces be provided for, and that the provinces be encouraged to utilize the revenue sources assigned to them through the Constitution so that they are able to even leverage further resources through borrowing. In the short term, the FSC recommends that the current structure of the provincial equitable share formula should be retained and brought closer to an equalization grant. This means that the grant should be framed such that expenditure needs minus revenue raising capacity equal the grant. This is where our hard choices that come with the IGFR system become evident. Hard choices in that we must now look the IGFR system in the face and say, despite resource constraints, money must be found. Put simply, each sphere of government must be made responsible and accountable for the choices it makes. The FSC further recommends that in the medium term, government should consider separating education and health from the provincial equitable share formula, and that the constituent components should be converted into distinct block grants. The equalization grant should be implemented fully in the medium term. Under block grants, the provincial government will have an obligation to spend the grant in a particular expenditure area such as primary education, but will also be free to determine how the funds are used within that area. In a reformed expenditure assignment system, these services will be recognized as fully delegated by national to provinces. Under this arrangement, the national departments will have full responsibility to secure funds for this function. However, the provinces will have the discretion to augment funding through more effective exploitation of their existing revenue sources as provided for through the Provincial Tax Regulation Process Act of 2003 and Section 228 of the Constitution. The national government should set the norms and standards as well as determine the minimum expenditure needs for both education and health. The Commission is aware that transition from the status quo to the new dispensation can be expensive and potentially disruptive to service delivery if not managed expeditiously. Consequently, it is further recommended that a dedicated intergovernmental committee be established to manage the transition process. I'll say a few words on the strategic issues for the short to medium term. As part of its response to the 2009 Division of Revenue, the Commission identified the following strategic issues as areas requiring a significant amount of focus for the government in the short to medium term. These are issues that the Commission will be following very closely in the next year. The Commission notes with concern that there is an increased proliferation of conditional grants. This concern was initially raised by the Commission in its 2006 Division of Revenue. This was particularly pointed out at an increase in small grants. The government indicated that it would attend to this issue with the objective of consolidating these grants and incorporating them into the equitable share. An examination of the 2009 medium-term expenditure framework, the Commission observes that these conditional grants are small and are mainly once-off. The Commission is of the view that this tendency might be revealing tensions between national and subnational governments on concurrent functions. What is of note here, firstly, is that a large number of small conditional grants tend to obscure the major policy priorities of government in favor of often changing sector priorities. That is, in this case, the national government may think that it is controlling through this small grant when in fact it is not. Secondly, historically, these small grants have tended to be poorly managed with low expenditure levels and limited impacts, and more so because they tend to ignore self-funded initiatives in these sectors by subnationals. The Commission is concerned about the number of instances where policy implementation stalls for protracted periods, resulting in negative impacts on the intergovernmental fiscal system. Areas where policy has stalled include the regional electricity distributors, or REDs, primary healthcare, and process formulation of a white paper on provincial government and the review of the white paper on local government by the former Department of Provincial and Local Government. It is very important that the white paper process is finalized sooner than later, as there is great expectation from stakeholders that part of the outcome would be to address the perennial problems associated with powers and functions of the different spheres of government. Past stalling has had severe negative effects on quality of service due to municipal uncertainty and thus underinvestment, to the point at which the full cost of now implementing most likely outweighs any benefits they may deliver. That is implementing, the cost here would include cost of delays, impact on local government finance, transition costs, and other costs. The proposed reforms may thus be no longer a priority and need substantial re-evaluation. Times have changed and new ideas are needed. We conclude by saying, as always, the Commission thanks the staff of the FFC, our stakeholders in government, for the support they have provided over the current research cycle. Special thanks go to the former Minister of Finance, Honorable Trevor Manuel, for the support he has given to the FFC over the years. The Commission wishes him well in his new undertaking. The Financial and Fiscal Commission further welcomes the new Minister of Finance, Honorable Pravin Gordhan, and expresses the hope that the robust engagement that has characterized interaction between the two institutions will continue. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Sotai. I'm just going to open up for questions, and I'm going to take one question at a time. I'll start with you, and then I'll come to you, and then I'll come to one, two, three, four.
Andre Yodan from SABC. Firstly, I'd just like to establish that we are going to get copies of that statement that Dr. Sotai read. It differs from what we've got here.
Yes.
And then I wonder, Dr. Sotai, if all your recommendations were implemented, could you, in a sort of a nutshell, say how that would change the relationship between national and provincial government?
No, I think it would be as reflected in the Constitution, because it's really a matter of the Constitution is still a work in progress in some ways. So the idea is to just continue along what the Constitution is calling for. And what we are doing now is just fine-tuning the system. There's really no opposition or people taking different positions on what the Constitution mandates. Thank you.
Mike Cohen from Bloomberg News. Could you just tell us, how closely has Treasury followed the FEC's recommendations to date? I mean, to what degree does what's reflected in the budget track what the FEC's done in its previous work? And then just a second one, do you have any views on the 17th Constitutional Amendment Bill, whereby the national government can tell other spheres of government to adhere to national policy priorities, whether that will impact at all on the recommendations that you've made in this report? Thanks.
Tanya, would you want to respond to that?
Yes.
I think the first one is on how the Treasury follows our recommendations.
Let me take that.
You could take it. Yeah.
I think that what happens is that we make our recommendations, and then Treasury comments on whether they will implement it or not. We find that most of our recommendations are actually agreed to by Treasury. Where we need to follow up on is to make sure that agreement translates into actual implementation. So you'll find that there are some areas of disagreement, but in general, we get quite a good agreement response. Whether that agreement response results in implementation on the ground, that's something that we need to follow up on. And that's why our research strategy has moved from focusing only on the allocations to say, well, has it resulted in impact on service delivery and improved outcomes to the community?
Yeah. In fact, I should also add that we have a new function in the FFC, which is budget analysis. And what we'll be looking for in that is to see whether, in fact, what the Treasury has agreed, because normally what the Treasury agrees to, it will make sure that there are resources. And what we now need to do is to follow from the Treasury onward inside the budget themselves to see whether, there's room for that. And that remains sort of as a new challenge for us, and because it's a new function, but we hope, you know, to carry it forward. And in fact, it's also one of the reasons when we say stakeholders are saying we must follow up on our recommendations, we're also responding to that stakeholder demand, especially the provincial legislatures, who then say, okay, you have recommended, and they may not always know what we have recommended, even though we have interacted with them, you know, we have given them information and all, but then it sort of behooves us to think on our feet and be able to answer immediately to them when we go to them out there to say, no, we recommended this and we saw it in your budget. And then I think it will be up to them in oversight to see whether in fact those things were implemented. The other one was an actor.
Yeah, the question relating to the 17th Amendment, let me be upfront by saying that here basically I won't be committing the commission to any views on that one, because the commission has not yet been formally given the document, so there's no commission view. But what I can say is that what Dr. Sitai spoke about in terms of the tensions around balancing national priorities against sub-national priorities without necessarily encroaching unduly on the discretion of sub-national governments is quite an important aspect of that. So in that respect, there is a degree of resonance in that amendment with the recommendations that we need to find a balance in terms of, because the design of the intergovernmental fiscal relations system really must respond to those kinds of policy decisions that are taken at a national level, mm-hmm. and at the same time take cognizance of decisions that are taken at a sub-national government level, which must be taken as those sub-nationals in terms of the constitution, they have their own distinct rights in terms of those decisions that they must actually take. So to balance that, I would say my view is that there is some resonance in the amendment and what the commission is proposing.
I was going to go to the honourable member and then the gentleman. And then I'll come back.
Thank you, the deputy chairperson. My name is Gauta Mukoro from the Northern Cape, and I must say what I'm going to say here. I'll be speaking specifically about the Northern Cape. In my view, as one of the provinces that throughout history has always been disadvantaged. Now, I understand that the mandate of the Financial Fiscal Commission is to look around different provinces and make recommendations. I'm specifically going to speak about that recommendation. I feel that that recommendation must be coupled with substantive facts and evidence regarding each and every province. As I say, the Northern Cape has always been a province that really never received, you know, serious attention. I'm saying, you know, when you consider recommendations regarding all the provinces, the Northern Cape must get a special attention for the fact that it is one-third of this country. And the distances that you travel from one point to the other, that what you can travel when you leave Johannesburg to Pretoria, which is less than an hour, in the Northern Cape, if you want to move from point A to point B, it's going to take you something like 4 to 5 hours to reach that point. Now, that alone is something that I regard as can be used by the Fiscal Commission when recommending budget for the Northern Cape. More so, the Northern Cape is a province that has the capacity in terms of what comes out of the Northern Cape culturally, if it can really be given a special attention, Northern Cape can be one of the, you know, provinces that produces agriculturally, you know, to contribute to the GDP of the country, and mining as well. When I speak about mining, you can just as well imagine how many mines are in the Northern Cape.
Honourable Member, can I just cut, because I think where you are going is actually going to be part of the agenda when we actually look at the recommendation that we put in committee.
Give me a chance.
I would like to, because I would like to allow the members of the press to ask their questions. Then I will come back to you. I will respond to your question.
Thank you.
As soon as we have finished dealing with this, I will come back to your question when I close. Because it's actually a very long story that you are coming up with, and we have tried so much to deal with it. Can I just go to you?
Hi, Tebe Mabanga from the Financial Mail. I just like two questions, or one question in two parts. What is the FFC's view on the government's ability to maintain expanding social spending, like increase the number of people covered by grants, and undertake the planned infrastructure spending in the face of falling revenue because of the economic meltdown over the MTF period? Has the FFC formulated a view on those two aspects of the budget? Thanks.
Can I ask Tanya to respond to that?
Well, in terms of our research, we've got quite a sophisticated set of macroeconomic and CGE models where we can feed in different scenarios and try and get an understanding of what the impact would be. And I think that in terms of the current level of deficit, and we feel that that's sustainable, mainly as a result of the good fiscal, prudent fiscal behaviours in the past, which has created fiscal room for us now. In terms of the infrastructure, as we all know, we're going into a recession. It's appropriate for us to be stimulating the economy. Now, normally what happens is when you start going into a recession, that's when you start putting your plans in place. We've been lucky in the sense that we've gone through quite rigorous planning, and now we can go through and implement. I think that where we have made some comments on is on the social grant system, if you look at our recommendations. And I think that there is a concern within the FSC about how do you balance, you know, the need to cushion the poor and the vulnerable in conditions of economic downturn, but at the same time prevent dependency. And when one rolls out the system further, there seems to be some sort of trade-off between expanding coverage, in other words, getting more people in the system, and increasing the entitlements, in other words, giving more to the people who are currently there. And then one also needs to locate social security payments within the broader context of a safety net. And so the question then becomes, about, you know, how are we going to use non-cash transfers? How are we going to use perhaps workfare, which has been piloted in other countries, where you don't just focus on grants, but you also look at developing skills, you know, drawing people into the economy. And some of these options could be fruitful avenues for further research and further policy development, and we pick up on that in our recommendations.
Dr. Sitha, I'm the info from Business Day. If one had to look back to 94 or 96 and now, and that tension that you talk about between subnational and central government, there's a sort of envelope that one could play in, perhaps, over concurrent functions and how they divide it out. Is it possible to note what the trend is in that tension toward maybe a more centralizing tendency or more delegating tendency, and what's driving that? Is that inefficiencies or lack of capacity at subnational governments, or how do you understand the evolving picture of that tension? Thanks.
Yeah, let me respond to that. I think from the perspective of the Commission, there is definitely a tendency towards more centralization, and partly I think it's because of the extent of the need on the ground. Basically, so if you look at the transfer system, how it has evolved, I think one of the issues that we raise is the tendency to depend quite rapidly on conditional grants. So you want to correct something that is not working, you introduce a conditional grant to try and deal with that kind of behavior. But you're really looking at national priorities versus what might be considered a provincial or a local government priority. So there has certainly been that tendency. And I think from the FFC's vantage point, we do sit in some of these intergovernmental forums where some of these decisions get taken. Now, one would ideally expect that in these intergovernmental forums, like your MINMEX, your budget councils, budget forum, the discussion is at an equal level. But the reality is that there tends to be quite a significant dominance by national departments on the processes that basically take place. And as a result, partly it's also a result of the capacity issues that you might be faced with at sub-national government level, which might actually manifest themselves in that kind of a discourse around key policy decisions, which ultimately translate into resources that must be laid out to address some of those things. I think the tendency is definitely on them. Yeah,
in a way also it's an issue of mandates, because national has certain mandates, and then provinces have also other mandates. And then it's just a question of now negotiating those mandates. But very often, because the provinces have their own legislatures, they are subjected to different pressures as well. That may tend to frustrate national, in that national may say so much on education per child, but then it doesn't work out that way, because the province had also other pressing issues. So I think our recommendation here on block grants is attempting to get that balance, so that, you know, that tendency does not predominate over a long period. So we are just trying to say, okay, if so much must be spent on primary education, let it be spent purely on primary education, and then the province itself can shift it within that sector, whichever way it wants. We were hoping that that will balance the situation.
You note with concern the expansion of conditional grants. Have conditional grants been effective in achieving what they were intended to achieve as an instrument?
You want to take
it? Okay. Well, I think the issues around conditional grants, basically the results are mixed. There are certain areas where conditional grants have played the role in which, for which they were intended. For example, if you pick up on some of the relatively successful ones, you would probably look at the school nutrition program in quite a number of provinces. That's been quite successful. You can pick on the health conditional grants, especially your HIV AIDS conditional grants, from when they were introduced, I think around about 2000 thereabouts. You find that there's been quite a significant take up, and they have actually been achieving what they were intended to do. There are some conditional grants that we basically are not sure. And I think in the submission itself, we deal with conditional grants that have been set aside for capacity building, for example. Whether it's because they are poorly defined, because we still talk about capacity, but if you work backwards and look at how much money has actually been pumped into capacity building programs, and then you take stock of where that capacity is, you're probably still sitting at the same kind of a position as if you haven't done anything about it. And in fact, what we see is increased service delivery failure related protests and all of that. So the evidence, I would say, it's very mixed with that.
And in our analysis, we are saying as they proliferate, they are also very small, and they are once-off. And therefore, we are saying that it's possible that there are certain policy stresses that this many conditional grants are hiding, and you know that becomes sort of a challenge for the future to find out where they are.
Can I take the gentleman there, and then I'm going to wrap up with the response to the member. Okay, let me just take that.
Sorry, Linda is busy asking all the questions I was going to ask. My name is Michael Hanlon from iNetBridge. I was wondering when you say resonate, the 17th Amendment resonates with what you're saying here. Do you mean that you approve of what the 17th Amendment is doing or proposing to do, that you think that there ought to be more central power or not? And secondly, when Tanya says that you're monitoring the implementation of your recommendations, and some of them, but you didn't say what the effect of that was. Have you discovered where they're not being implemented, even though agreed to?
Let me start by... I prefixed my response by saying I'm speaking on my behalf here. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Commission because the Commission has not taken a position on that, so we can't, both Dr. Sitai and myself can't take that liberty to. But certainly, from where I sit, there are certain aspects. When I say resonates, I'm not saying that I approve or not. I haven't actually gone through the detail of it, but I think there are certain aspects from the brief look that I've done, there are certain aspects that I would identify with in terms of the issues that we're trying to deal with, which would assist us in the work of designing effective intergovernmental transfer system. Now, Tanya, do you want to respond, and then I'll quickly respond to the...
Okay, just coming back to Treasury's response to our recommendations. Every year, when they publish their annual budget review, there is an ICSAE. In an ICSAE, they go through each of our recommendations and they say what they agree with and why, and what they disagree with and why. Now, the issue is that Treasury allocates funds, but it's the actual line departments at national, provincial, and within the municipalities that do the implementation. And you'll notice that some of our sectoral recommendations have implications not only for the national provincial treasuries, but also for the corresponding line departments at national provincial level and also for municipalities as well. And so there can be quite a lag between when there's a conceptual agreement and when the intergovernmental system responds because of all the intergovernmental budgeting and planning process that goes through. And so therefore, it's not necessarily that there's unwillingness, but there is a long lag in such a complex and often fragmented system to make sure that it actually results in changed allocations and changed service delivery on the ground, and that's what we focus on.
Okay, let me wrap up by responding to the honourable member. Question, and I think it's a good thing that you basically mentioned that you're speaking for the Northern Cape, and I think from the beginning, from the outset, when the revenue sharing formula, the provincial equitable share formula, was first proposed, the issue of the Northern Cape was actually recognized as a very big problem. You have here, you have the largest province in the country with the smallest population. Now, the formula, the way in which it's designed in such a way that it targets people. So probably about 93% of the formula is actually related, the allocation will be related to the number of people that reside in the province. And so in that, on that score alone, the Northern Cape loses quite significantly. In fact, the discussions around the Northern Cape were characterized as the Northern Cape problem. I don't know whether it's actually a problem, but it was characterized as the Northern Cape problem. Now, in order to deal with that, and what you talk about, your distances that you have to cover and all of that,
and many others.
I haven't talked, I haven't spoken about, you refer to your economic activity, what comes out of the Northern Cape and relative to what you get. Now, what happens is that in terms of the formula itself, currently what compensates the Northern Cape is what is called the institutional component of the formula. That allocates equal amounts to each province. Now, if you look at the number of people, so on a per capita terms, if we allocate, say, 10 billion rand per province, it's not that much. But Northern Cape, in per capita terms, basically receives the bigger chunk. And so the principle is that the money basically is allocated based on the people that you have. So that tries to address that problem. Now, whether or not it addresses it fully is now the issue that we must deal with. And like I said, in the technical report that we have, and I think in terms of facts that you're demanding that the commission needs to look at the facts. The facts basically are there. We spent quite a lot of time having discussions primarily with the provincial treasurers. I must say that in terms of the reference group for the review of the equitable share formula, we had the 9 provincial heads of treasuries as the reference group. So the base information that was used was basically collected from each province. Each province was expected to submit every little study that it has done around its own economic activity, its own socioeconomic profile. So we have all that kind of information, and we worked it out that way. But let me say, reassure you that when we come to deal with the recommendations in the committee, we will deal in more detail to explain what some of the issues are and show some numbers, basically what it does.
Thank you so much. It's just that as we are in recession now, perhaps you could project some of the kind of tensions in the intergovernmental system and the division of revenue that's already been approved or that's going to be approved by Parliament. What does the recession hold in store for our?
Let me. What we've done is like we've brought our director of the research program here, and the question that you're asking requires research now. Ramos, can you respond to that?
Maybe our friend also indicate that the budgets were.
Thank you. I think the impact of the financial crisis is a challenge to everyone, and it's turning out to be much deeper than anticipated. For instance, towards the end of last year, what we're able to do now, based on the experiences of other countries and the structure of the South African economy, is to say that the amounts that are locked in the MTEF are quite reasonable for the shocks that the system is likely to go through in the next 2 to 3 quarters. And what we essentially anticipate is that there will be room to maintain the plans, provided there is an increased appetite to explore other funding sources, such as external borrowing, for example. And our simulations or the forecast suggests that even increasing up to 10% of the infrastructure baseline will not harm significantly our our current account deficit, but beyond an extra 80 billion on infrastructure, you will start to get the macroeconomy shaking. So I guess what I'm saying is the assumptions that are locked into the NPF are quite reasonable based on how we're anticipating the economy to respond to the financial crisis. And there is room to explore other funding alternatives, especially for infrastructure within the short term.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. We come to the end of the session. I think, as we promised, we should be able, Henry, to hand out that statement.